Radio.
Glasgow Midwives and the Fight for Conscience. A talk by Mary Dugan.
Thanks very much for inviting me and bringing me to this meeting today and for coming along yourselves. I've been in Australia now for just under 3 weeks, and in all truth, if you'd said to me 2 years ago that this would be something that would develop from what's been going on for the past 7 years between myself and a colleague and the Greater Glasgow Health Board, I would have just not believed it. So it's been a huge shock for me to actually find myself halfway around the world talking about something that was very personal to me, but which seems to be striking a note right across the board. And I had some understanding of, because I think if you're instinctively pro-life and concerned about the way society is going, we're all tuned into what's going on in different parts of the world. So I was aware of some things out here, but certainly since I've come to Australia and learned about the problems you yourself are having, then I don't think they're coincidences that maybe God has brought me out here. I'm no great fan of long-distance flights, and probably if it was left to me myself, I would... I love looking at films and pictures, but I'm quite a homebird now. So anyway, I find myself out here, and it was through Karen's husband, John, he brought a friend of mine from Scotland a few years ago. So I don't know if he's ever down here, Tommy Canning. He's a Catholic artist who does lovely, terrific work in churches and his paintings. And Tommy was out 2 years ago through John, visiting various parts of Australia, New Zealand, the Solomon Islands, various things. And Tommy told me that he'd gone into a Catholic church and seen at the back of the church a bulletin that said, "Pray for the Scottish midwives." Mm-hmm. So he was quite intrigued about that. And of course, he mentioned to John. And he told me as well about it. But by that time, because we'd been fighting this issue for quite a few years, I wasn't surprised, because I knew that our case is really resonating around the world for the reasons you've just given for your end-of-life issues, so people are aware of it. But I still never took seriously any potential possibility of coming out here. But if I can give you a wee background to it, because... maybe a bit of a story about myself and what my background is as well. I'm a midwife who's been working in the health service in the UK for the past... since... I trained in 1975. I became a midwife in 79. Most of my work has been in midwifery. I spent 5.5 years in the early stages in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, which was a great experience. And I bring that into my conversation because it gave me a chance to see what it was like working in an environment where they didn't do abortion. They had a sacred approach to childbirth, and it was really not allowed to carry out abortion. One thing I'll explain as well is that when I talk about the cases that I've been involved with, these are the disabled babies. These are the children that they detect some kind of problem on. And nowadays you'll hear expressions like severe disability. Well, in fact, that's quite mild. It's usually incompatible with life. That's the terminology that's used to dehumanise the child, so that if it's incompatible with life, people think it's not going to live. You have no choice but to have terminate the baby's life. But in truth, these babies are not all incompatible with life. Mm-hmm. And I'll explain that again as we go along. But that's the children who are affecting me and Connie Woods, my colleague and friend, so that people understand it's about less than 2% of the terminations that are carried out in the UK. So I went to the Middle East. I worked there for 5.5 years. I came back to Glasgow and I got a post as a labour ward sister fairly quickly at the hospital, which is where I've had the dispute. Initially, when I went to work there, it's a hospital called the Southern General Hospital. The NHS, if you don't know, it's like we all train in the National Health Service. I know you have a different system out here, maybe in Hobart, the same way you might have private hospitals, which are Catholic or Christian based. So you can exercise your own ethos and principles much more easily. And that doesn't really work that way in the UK. We are all trained in the National Health Service. And if you want to be a nurse, midwife or a doctor, that's what you've got to do your training. But through that process, and whatever is accepted as normal practice in that environment, you have a good chance of being involved along the way, with some quite contentious issues. Now, even if you want to withdraw and go work somewhere else, it doesn't happen that much in Scotland because we have very, very few private healthcare facilities and certainly no maternity. So you work in the National Health Service as a midwife. Tiny, tiny number may do it as private, but it's so small, it's just not worth mentioning. So when I first was qualified as a midwife in 78, well, even before that, when I went into midwifery in 75, the Abortion Act in Britain had been passed in 1967. And one of the things I've been talking about the past 2.5 weeks is that I never became pro-life. I always was. And I think the way that the language is used today, it's like a label that gets put onto people. And I think you've got to opt out of being pro-life. You know, and I think that's some of the language we can actually use and try and reclaim. Because if you're living, you have to be pro-life. If you see what I'm talking about. So my question would be, you're not pro-life? You know, not that I'm pro-life. Do you see the difference? It's just, anyway, because I can't remember a time when I didn't feel, and I wasn't aware of the sanctity of life. My parents are from Ireland, from Donegal, very strong Catholic background. My father took ill when we were all very young. My mother, there were 7 of us, and my father had a brain tumour and became very ill with that. So he was spent many years in hospital, blind and paralysed, before he passed away in 1973. And my mother had that whole burden herself, and she was a single parent, as I say, before it became fashionable. It was a time when they didn't have material support the way they do today, and she had it very, very hard. I don't feel that we had it as hard as, not at all, as she did. Times were hard, and certainly I feel that God will all get across in life at some point, and for me the best time to get it was at the start. Because although it was materially poor, it was spiritually very, very rich. And I feel that I've been a millionaire where love is concerned. So that was the environment I was brought up in. My youngest sister, Brage, lived for 3 weeks, and she was born with spina bifida and hydrocephaly. And I remember the time she was born. I was about 8 years of age, and we lived in tenement area in the Gorbals of Glasgow, which is a very poor area, but great community spirit. And we knew my mother was going to have another baby, but then there was a sense of sadness that enveloped the whole place. And then we learned that the child, our little sister, was very ill and wasn't expected to live. Through the 3 weeks of her life, we knew we couldn't really touch her or handle her the way you would want to do with a child. But there was one time my mother was making her cot, and she let me hold the baby. And I remember holding her and being terrified that I was going to move or do something to make her condition worse. So that's left a huge impression on me. And my little sister has been really with me throughout this past 3 weeks, which I feel brilliant, terrific. So, as I say, I didn't become pro-life. I always was. So 67, I can't really remember too much about that time. Perhaps there was conversation and people were appalled that the Abortion Act had been passed, which, as probably you know, it didn't give a right to women to abort. It just decriminalised the activity and said that a woman could obtain an abortion in the National Health Service under certain, you know, guidelines and conditions, and carried out by a doctor. Most of them now are carried out on the basis that a woman has a mental health problem. 98% in the UK, that's what it is. Actually, it's just a form of contraception, has been for many years. It's backing up failed contraception, and that's the vast majority of terminations under those conditions. This, on paper, it's still what they say if the woman's got mental health or problems with mental health. However, it was the children, as I said, the disabled children that would impact on me. Going through my nurse training, I was aware that the gynaecology ward was the area you might be compromised. And I, at the start of my nursing career, I read up everything I could on my own. I'm a Catholic Christian, what the church's teachings were. I spoke to some priests. I wanted to understand exactly what it was I was to withdraw from and what circumstances, all the rest of it. So I was very well versed, as it turns out. So I never got compromised in my training as a nurse. And of course, then I did midwifery. I could have been compromised there, but it didn't happen, thank God. So I went to work in the Middle East, got great experience, and then came back to the UK and started to work in this particular hospital in 1988. That hospital had a Catholic ethos. Although there was no Catholic hospitals, it used to be a poorhouse before the introduction of the National Health Service. And in 1948, when that all changed, you had the establishment of various hospitals. Sadly, in the west of Scotland, there's still some of the remains of the Northern Ireland business, where it was difficult for Catholics to get jobs of significance. Certainly in the general hospitals, doctors, nurses, midwives found it great difficulty to actually get promoted posts. So the Southern General had no great kudos about it, because the history was it was a poorhouse. So that's in fact where quite a number of Catholics found work. They weren't all Catholic, and it wasn't a Catholic hospital, but that's why there was this presence there. So when I went to work there in 1988, the manager of midwifery was a very strong pro-life senior midwife who opposed the 1967 Abortion Act. The consultant at the time was a practicing Catholic who was pro-life. When he retired, there was another consultant who took his position. He was also a practicing Catholic, and he didn't do abortion. Now, there were abortions carried out. I'm not trying to say it didn't happen. It did. But in the labour ward at that time, if you had 10 in the year, that was probably the most you would get. So although they were there, there was no great culture for them, and doctors would do them periodically. Now, there were quite a few of us who were senior managers who opposed abortion. We didn't, and there was never an issue about that. Everybody knew, or Mary doesn't, but it wasn't an issue at all, and whichever staff midwives. However, over the years, they cut back on the number of managers they had. So whilst there was always other sisters who could take charge of this case, if it was in, it became more of a problem because there were less of us around. It was still manageable because you were usually on with another manager. So, and for us, the principle, the point was that the sisters are expected to send somebody in to book the lady in and to make sure the abortion's done. Now, if you're a medical person, part of nursing, you'll know that, well, in midwifery, the managers can be passive or active, depends on who they are. We were always very active as midwifery sisters. It wasn't that sat in a room and didn't take part or help out. We did a lot of active work in our unit. But that is actually besides the point, because even if we did sit back in an office, if you're responsible for the moral responsibility of getting this abortion done, that's what it is. You are morally responsible. Yeah. This will be important for when we talk about the actual case. So there was no problem with the number of senior managers we had until they started reducing them, but it still wasn't a major problem. When it became a big problem was in 2005, because of the falling birth rate in Europe. Europe is growing old, most definitely. So in Scotland, the same thing. The maternity units were closing, so they decided to amalgamate some of the ones. There was about 9 or 10 when I first started working. We're down to 2 now, 2 bigger units, but they've amalgamated and making these 2 kind of super units, and it's awful. But anyway, so from this other hospital, there was a consultant transferred to our place, and she was given the responsibility of taking charge of the labour ward. And as I explained, we all work in the National Health Service. So the colleagues I have, most of them would look after women undergoing abortion. The doctors, the vast majority who choose obstetrics and gynaecology, will do so understanding that they're going to kill another human being. Now, although I feel passionately pro-life, I'm also very aware that we're in danger of demonising the people who do this. And they are doing it for what they see as the best of reasons. They try to do it to stop the backstreet abortion business. That's what it's about. So many of these people are my friends, and they're not two-headed monsters. They're just ordinary cross-section of humans like we are. It's just we've got a huge philosophical difference of how we manage this issue. So I just want to explain that from that point of view. So many of my friends will do and have carried out abortion. And over the years, I've spoken with them, I've dialogued with them. And when you know somebody, you know, socially or just even professionally, it's easier to do that if you've got courage and belief of what your viewpoint is. And it's harder. They tend to do the same with us. those pro-lifers, and we've run a couple of horns in our head and judging everybody, and it's not like that at all. So the benefit of working in the health service is you work together with people who carry out the abortion, and you could speak and influence them to some degree. However, this particular doctor, you know, when I'm talking about these colleagues and friends, I never felt in my heart what I felt about this particular doctor, a girl who came across, and I think this sums up how she, or where she was. She's a pretty girl. She got her first consultancy post with us, and she was expecting her first child when she came across. So she was about 16 weeks pregnant when we were introduced. And at one spot, one point of a shift with her, I was just trying to get to know, and I said, so you're due the baby in a number of months' time, whatever it was. I said, have you picked a name for your wee one? And she says, oh, no. She says, it's just a fetus. That tells you everything. It's a mother who's expecting a baby at 16 weeks. But that's where some people are. They don't want the humanity of that child in case they have to, or they choose to abort the baby. But I'd never come across anybody personally who gave me that answer. She actually then, what I discovered is she was taking charge of the fetal medicine unit, which we never had at the Southern. Now, the fetal medicine's got two sides of the coin. One side, if they can detect babies that have got a handicap that they can do something about, then they can prepare for that and do some terrific work in, you know, repairing something that's wrong with the child, maybe intrauterine, mostly after birth. However, the downside is that other babies that they detect, usually with genetic problems, the intention is to terminate. And the pressure that's on women, if that's detected, is enormous, and the vast majority of our handicapped babies are terminated. And one thing I can tell you is when they talk about us judging women because we don't want to take part in abortion, the truth of the matter is it's the other way around. If a woman chooses to hold on to her baby, then believe me, she has to run the gauntlet. And that doesn't stop even when her baby's born. It does not stop at all. And I've tried to explain what this is like for us in practice. You can have a situation where, I call it, it's a voluntary schizophrenic state. And that's because the same people that are involved with trying to create life through IVF and through people with persistent miscarriages and who are trying to do their best to sustain these babies and pregnancies, they're also doing the opposite with healthy babies and with disabled babies. But for us as midwives, we're trained to look after a mother and a child, the mother and the baby. If you've got a lady comes into the labour ward one particular day and she's got a baby who's that we know has got, let's say, Down syndrome, which is not uncommon, but she's chosen not to abort that baby's life. She comes to the labour ward and she's given all the support of the medical staff, the midwifery staff. She'll be spoken to by paediatricians and the obstetricians about the care that she's going to get when her baby's delivered. So that's that conversation, because that lady's got that condition with her child. So we're caring for the mother and the child. Could happen on the same day, or it could be a few days apart or whatever, but you will have a situation where another lady comes in another day with the same condition. Her baby's got some kind of disability. She's choosing to go through the termination. So we as midwives have got to switch off, talk to her, address the mother, and don't talk about the baby. When these babies are delivered, and by the way, it's now the midwives and in the gynaecology ward, it's the nurses who are carrying them out. Because it's now a medicalised activity rather than the surgical practice which was done in the early days and still is done. If they're done in theatre, it will be the obstetrician, gynaecologist who will do that. But mostly now, terminations are being done by nurses and midwives. On the gynaecology ward, the doctors prescribe it, but it's the nurses who give the administer it orally, the tablet, or vaginally, the pessary. And the same now applies to midwives in the labour ward. And many of my colleagues, actually, they don't want to deny a woman the care during the labour, the nursing care, but they would get doctors to come in to give the pessary because they feel that that's doing it. They don't see themselves supporting the woman through it as participating. A number of years ago, some of the senior staff made a decision at the higher echelons without asking midwives, did they want to administer the pessary? They made a decision they could do it. Now, nobody likes doing it, but the medical staff learned very quickly, I don't need to do this. So the pressure that's been put on the staff midwives to do the pessary is phenomenal. I mean, you've got a very busy unit. These girls who are prepared to look after the woman, who are not opposed to her choice, but they don't actually want to be responsible for it. Now they're all pressurised into administering the pessary. So have they have in effect become the abortionist stroke midwives for this procedure. When the baby is born, we take pictures, handprints, footprints, and if the baby's old enough, a little piece of the hair we cut from the baby to put into a booklet that's given to the mother. And that's so that we can normalise the practice of aborting handicapped children. The women who choose to have social terminations, which is when the baby's normal and healthy, they don't get that. In fact, they go off their head if these women are wanting to see their babies, you know, and they don't address that at all. So this doctor started bringing more of these early detected problems to the labour ward, and that's what started causing the problem for us. Because whereas we had perhaps 10 a year, now they were coming up much more frequently. So more staff were complaining and saying, I came into midwifery to deliver babies and bring life into the world. I didn't come in to do this. And I explained to many people, we deal with death. Dead babies, we get that. That happens. It's a very sad occasion when it does happen. And we're trained to help these women. But the atmosphere between a spontaneous loss that could have been by an accident, but very often it happens by whatever, for whatever reason. You can counsel and support women through that, and there's terrible grief, there's terrible pain, suffering and all the rest. There's no guilt. The day that a woman decides the hour her baby's going to, life's going to stop, it's night and day, and the atmosphere in the place is palpable. So that's the environment that the labour ward has become, and it's normalisation of it. So for me, what happened was, I knew that the Queen Mother's Hospital was going to be coming over to us. They had this much more aggressive approach to selecting and picking out detecting abnormalities. And they had referrals coming from outside Glasgow, from the islands, from Northern Ireland, from different parts of Scotland. And I knew that when they come over to us, it's going to get worse. But I had already started taking it to my managers that we had a problem. No, sorry, I didn't say we had a problem. I said, you have a problem because more girls are saying they're not going to be involved in this practice. And they knew, I don't deal with it either. You have a problem. What do you want to do about it? Now, if I didn't do that, I wouldn't be sitting here today. It wasn't that the hospital came looking to me and putting pressure. They were just leaving you with a problem. But what I was trying to do is to get them to deal with it before it was going to become critical with the amalgamation of the other unit. They danced the jig, didn't want to know. But eventually the manager I had, she agreed that they would have some discussions about it. However, with the closure of this hospital on the horizon, there was a decision that made that the manager from that place came over to us. It was a power struggle. And that manager we had, she went. So the new woman came across. She's younger than me, actually. But when I first met her, I just advised her, I said, oh, just to let you know, there is an unresolved issue in this unit about the management of fetal loss and specifically on the terminations that have been carried out. She was stunned because she'd never encountered any kind of opposition before. So anyway, that happened. But I was given her time to settle. Nothing got done. And that was round about end of July 2008. By October, things were not settling and staff were still complaining. So I decided to bring it up. There was a meeting of the ward staff. And I thought, rather than dialogue one-to-one, if you're in a group, a meeting like this, it's an official meeting, it's got to be minuted. So you can't ignore it. So I swallowed because it's a contentious issue. But I brought it up. Anyway, that was the first time I then heard this reinterpretation of what the 1967 Act actually meant. For me, I thought the biggest problem I was going to have was just dealing with it verbally and addressing it as a really hot potato. And that was the most I thought was going to happen, and they would deal with it. I never in my wildest dreams expected to be defending the principle of conscientious objection, which is what eventually happened. So that day that they started coming out with this other interpretation, which was saying that we didn't have to give the pessary and we didn't have to deliver the baby. And I thought, they don't know what they're talking about because The pessary wasn't, it hadn't been invented in 1967, so how could you get an exemption for something that wasn't in play? Secondly, the business with the baby. You don't know when the baby's going to be born. So how can you say to a woman, right, I'm leaving you now, somebody else will... That was such a nonsense. That was always our rights not to engage in any way with the care of a woman who was undergoing a termination. Totally accepted by all the other staff. But I think what's been going on in many places is they've been just ignoring that, and gradually over a period of time, they just think it's normal, and if anybody speaks out of line, it comes as a shock to some of them. But there's always somebody in some of the units who doesn't deal with terminations. So... But the first major shock of my whole life was the following day from this meeting. I decided to phone my professional body, the Nursing and Midwifery Council. You'll have an equivalent here, the General Medical Council of Hobart or Tasmania. Yeah. So I wasn't bothered about it, but I just phoned them for their advice. And I was stunned with what they told me. Because in effect, they were saying the same thing as the managers. And I couldn't believe it, because I had been really aware of our legal rights. And as it turns out, I knew more than many of the professionals throughout all the years I've been doing midwifery. I was aware of legal cases. And the reason I was very aware of it, because I've been actively pro-life in all that time, working out with my job with women post-abortive. That was always my interest. So for 20 years, under the umbrella of SPUC, which in the UK is the Society for the Protection of the Unborn Child, because it was always easy to talk about and discuss, as I said earlier, the loss of a baby through stillbirth or miscarriage. But those that you knew had a termination, first of all, you'd be terrified to bring the subject up because you didn't want to make matters worse. But I was very aware of the silent suffering of these women. And through SPUC, an umbrella group called British Victims of Abortion, who are a group of people who have had abortions, regretted the decision, and were there now working towards helping other women through education, through support. So I get a tremendous experience through that group, which has run parallel with my professional career for about 22, 24 years now. And I now look back, I know God was preparing me for what was lying ahead, because I was aware of the legal cases, as I said, which actually supported our position. And sometimes I was asked by some people would phone up from different parts of the country for advice, and I would speak to them about it. So that was all going on. So when the Nursing and Midwifery Council told me on the phone and said what they said about this, I couldn't believe it, because I knew that day I was in for a huge battle. Because I thought, if they're saying that, management's not going to back down. They're going to try and force us to take responsibility. And my stability was shaken to the core that day. I came home from work, and I've got an image of the Divine Mercy and the crucifix in the corner. And I dropped to my knees. Now, I'm not somebody who can tell you, go to this passage in Scripture or whatever. I read the Scriptures, but I'm not good at quoting. And I opened the Bible that day, and I said, first of all, I looked at Jesus, and I just says, "Dear God," I says, "this is huge." I says, "You're going to have to help me." And I opened the Bible at random. I see you've got it in here. And it was, I flicked a page, I thought, where am I? And it was Exodus chapter 1. I went straight to verse 15. But what went before it, and I'll explain this because you'll understand the relevance, is when the Hebrews were in captivity in Egypt, Pharaoh was getting very worried because they were growing in stature and size and numbers, and he tried to suppress them through heavy and hard work. It wasn't working. So at verse 15, which is the first bit I read, he called the Hebrew midwives, Shifra and Pua, and said, "Look between the stones," because the women bear down in stones to give birth. "If it's a girl, let her live. If it's a boy, kill him." But the midwives were God-fearing and wouldn't do as Pharaoh had told them. And Pharaoh called the midwives back again, said, "You haven't done what I've said, you should do." And the midwife said,
"Best reply ever."
Yeah. Isn't it? I see you put it in here.
I love it.
Yeah. So they said, "These Hebrew women have given birth before." I know off by heart. They've given birth. Yeah, that's right. So hey, God blessed the midwives, and Pharaoh did what he continued to do. But that passage, midwives, was mentioned 7 times. Because God realised how thick my brain is, how slow I would be. And that is a passage from Scripture that has sustained me for the past 7 years. Now, when I realised they were doing this, trying to redesign what the conscience clause meant, I conveyed this to some of my colleagues and we became seriously concerned. So it applied to staff midwives, it applied to, there was just two of us as sisters, and that's Connie Woods, great, wonderful Irish girl. She's fantastic. She's been my friend for many years as well as my colleague, and she wanted to come here, however, it was not possible. But Connie and I have been together through this, but we argue about who's shift and who's poor. So that started this whole journey. And of course, because of the work I'd done with SPUC, I never thought for one minute that the people I got to know through my voluntary work there were going to become my comrades in arms, so to speak. And they've given me terrific backing and support. But it started the legal journey. Now, it didn't get into the courts until much later. But initially, I had to deal with the managers and then start writing letters. And for about a year and a half, it went backwards and forwards. It was very, very stressful. The unions completely undermined us. The Royal College of Midwives, they took a position which totally undermined our position. They wrote an article in 97, which really is what they were trying to push, the NMC was trying to push, and which ultimately, it's small people in positions of authority and power that miss and turn around the law and change it to suit themselves. So that's what the Royal College had done. So we had no union representation, so it was just myself and Connie, and mostly myself who was writing the letters. So that went on, and because then we were putting it into letter form, the managers became very worried. So they backed down. After about a year and a half, they backed down because they knew we continued to mean business. But this time, the confusion was set amongst the staff. People were being told that they had to do this, that, and the next thing. But when they backed down, I couldn't believe it, that they actually gave in. So the staff midwives in particular were quite safe, but they also said to us that whatever you did beforehand, and what we did do beforehand was, we never took responsibility if a woman was in the ward to undergo termination. We never delegated. Staff self-delegated if they came on with us. And there were always doctors, and there were plenty of people around that could take part in that. So we never, ever took moral responsibility for this case. So they agreed that we could carry on doing that. And that was great. So we got them to back down, and I thought, that's fine. But by this time, the amalgamation had occurred. And I thought it was a terrible environment to work in. And I will tell you also that before they actually opened the new maternity, it was a labour ward, a new labour ward with two special care nurseries above. They spent $10 million, $20 million, Australian dollars, equivalent, to build this new unit. They did a pagan ceremony before they opened it. And I can tell you, you can feel it. The number of staff that, even since I've been away, the number of people that want out of there is unbelievable. They did a full pagan ceremony in that place. Anyway, but I had made my mind up that I was going to finish this off, get it sorted out, and then I was going to go and do some work with, leave midwifery and go and do some work with pro-life. So I had this in my heart. It was very heavy burden working in the environment where people were really, the new staff that came over, they were awful and terrible. So I'd made this, but you had to keep it to yourself. So very few people knew about it. Anyway, after 6 months, they hadn't resolved what was going on in practice. It was still difficult and there was still confusion. So I wrote another letter that says, if it's not resolved properly, we're going to have to reinitiate the grievance. We had been in dialogue for a year and a half, and I had started a grievance, but then they stopped and said, no, we're okay. So we didn't make it a grievance. But then when I said I was threatened to do it, they wrote another letter. We had a meeting, an acrimonious meeting, but they put down something in a letter which says, we have told you, you have a right to withdraw from, you have a right to conscientious objection and don't have to participate in termination, but you cannot withdraw care from a woman undergoing termination of pregnancy. Well, the English in that is saying to me, I cannot withdraw. But much later on, it turns out that what this manager meant was, care cannot be withdrawn, which is another issue altogether. I mean, that's not saying I have to do it. So anyway, I'd said, no, get that line out of this before we dialogue. And then they decided they would contact the Central Legal Office, which we'd been asking them to do for 2 years. Now, I think what's happened is they phoned up the legal office for the health board, gave them some snippet of information, which would be very vague. They hadn't a clue what was going on. And the legal people just says, do not amend the letter. I got an email the following day. I'd come off a shift and I was very, very upset the way. It was a terrible shift and I was feeling very heavy burdened. And then I got that email to say, we're not amending the letter, been in touch with Central Legal Office. Carry on your grievance if you wish. There's no point in any further meetings. And it was like throwing a gauntlet down. And for me, I knew that is just the start of this battle. I'd been fighting it for almost 2 years, but that was really it just starting then. And it shattered me. I've not been back at work since that day. My health deteriorated. I had very high blood pressure. I came out in a condition called angioedema urticaria, which is, I felt like a total blister for the best part of 3 years. I was on steroids. My face would all swell up. They took pictures of me for the lawyers wanted to see and all the rest of it. It was an awful condition, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody. But I haven't worked since that day. But the point is, although I was on sick for a year, I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't resign. And they obeyed not to sack me because the case. So I couldn't move anywhere. And I've been employed until just within the past 2 months, and 6 weeks, in fact, since my resignation's gone in now. But I couldn't go to another job whilst this was on. So in effect, I was stuck in that place, unwell, unpaid, far from home. You feel sorry? I don't know. Anyway, the point is, it was awful. It was really terrible. But one thing about that I will say, and this maybe applies to something that's worth thinking about for yourselves as you go towards some of the very contentious issues that lie ahead in other areas of law at the moment, that no matter how difficult this journey has been, God has sustained myself and Connie throughout it all. And many people said to me, look, Mary, you must think about your health. But I would be more ill if I didn't carry on this battle. I knew that God gave me some grace to do that. It's not coming from me, not at all. So he will give you some grace to do it. Life is hard. Every one of you will have some hardship outside that's got nothing to do with the moral issues of the battles that we're taking on today. So it just so happened that I had my cross to carry at that time, but I never once gave it any second thought that I wouldn't continue. That just didn't enter the equation at all. So anyway, we got through the whole hospital saga before we could actually get it into the hands of lawyers. And in total, we attended about 15, 16 meetings with the hierarchy, all the different steps and stages along the way. I have to say, the health board, when they finally wrote their letter and said no, they didn't uphold us our rights to grievance, but the panel were impressed by your sincerity. You know, I think they liked us, think that's what they're trying to say. But anyway, we get out of the hands of the health board then, and into the hands of the lawyers, and that then progressed into the public case that became very, very well known, actually throughout the world, for people who are interested in this subject. And you said yourself, it's the conscience issue. It was over abortion, but the issue is conscience. And you can bring people in from other areas who would not be with us ideologically, but who recognise the great danger to conscience that this is. Now, you probably, or maybe you don't know, the first legal case we had was through in Edinburgh in front of Lady Smith in January 2010. And we knew when we went in, we knew the way she was handling it. I'm going to say it, law is an ass. You know, it's not truth, it should be truth, but they've got their own ideology as well, and wherever they want to be. I learned that very quickly. No matter how good a lawyer or a QC can be in putting forward the best of arguments, if the judge has got his or her own opinion, they can make a bad case the way they want to, you know, give victory to them. So we lost the first round, and then we appealed it. It went back to Edinburgh in 2011, and that was in front of three judges. And thanks be to God, they never mentioned religion once, because it is not a religious issue. We happen to be two Catholics, but we're not contesting this because we're Catholics. It's because we have a conscience, and I think it's an insult to atheists to say, you know, it's just a Catholic issue. Rubbish. Anyway, we won that when three judges unanimously supported our position. The lady, Doreen, who wrote up the case, I know that she wouldn't agree with us necessarily ideologically, but I wasn't looking for anybody to give us any favours. On the issue of conscience, what the interpretation of the Act said, and the other legal cases that I was aware of, they went through them and understood them perfectly and gave a very good reasoned argument in our favour. So that was three judges in Edinburgh in 2011. It was appealed by the Health Board, went back down to London Supreme Court. Last year, we went down on the 11th of the 11th, 2014. And for me, it was staring me right in the face. The 11th of the 11th, Armistice Day. And I knew as soon as I saw that date, I thought that's hugely significant. And when we were in the court, 11 minutes past 11, we all stood for 2 minutes silence. And outside, thousands and thousands of poppies. And just so many people just didn't get the connection. Anyway, I thought we would be successful because there was huge numbers praying for us from all over the world. We had people contacting us and recognising what was going on. So it was because of prayer I thought we would win it. So myself and Connie went into the court and felt very, very optimistic. We are human beings, but we did want to win it, you know. So although we were praying, it was only about a week before I started contemplating, what if we don't win this? Because we had come through the whole judiciary, and this was the furthest it could go in the courts on this argument on what did the act actually mean, participating in treatment. That was the two words that hung on. So we went into court, and as soon as the judges came out, you knew. They had made their minds up before actually the court hearing was out. So Lady Hale, who did the write-up, my belief is she'd probably written it before she even heard the arguments, because they read over your points. She's a known feminist. She also is very anti-SPUC, the organisation that backed us. And I have friends who are lawyers, and again, who are not ideologically with us, and who think it's a travesty of justice. I have another friend who's a lecturer of law, and she's written extensively about this, and she's spoken at different meetings with other lecturers of law and said that this has been a poorly reasoned argument, and she's really been scathing about it. And they haven't argued about that. But basically, she let her own ideology come in, and she's not only tossed out our rights, she's narrowed it down to such an extent that for us as managers, it's completely meaningless. We don't have any rights now to conscientiously object. That's what she's written. Also, she's gone out of her way to narrow the rights of doctors and every other healthcare worker involved. What she's saying is that checking a drug that's going to be administered for the abortion, whether it's potassium chloride, which is injected into the baby's heart, intrauterine, if they want to kill the baby before it's born, we check that drug. If they don't need us, why do they need us to check it? You need to get two people to check the drug before it's administered to anyone. Checking the drug does not constitute taking part. So many things about it. And she purposely went out of her way to say that the principles that apply in criminal law, which is association of activity, like someone sitting outside with a car driving, you know, the engine going, somebody's robbing a bank, they come out, that person's implicated as well. We all know that is a principle of, you know, participation. But she purposely said that didn't apply where this, the Conscience Act in the 1967 Act was concerned. So she really has gone out of her way to really suppress rights. And that's what it's all about. I read a document around about 2004 that said that there was a great need to suppress conscience right across the board. And by the way, the reason they need midwives and nurses is because of the number of doctors who don't want to take part. It's very hard to get doctors in the UK to go into obstetrics and gynaecology now. Not mostly, but large numbers are coming from Eastern Europe or other parts of the world where folk do it more readily. But it's because of that they're wanting to sort of push that it's a compulsory part of our training. And when I read this document about a meeting that took place in England, international individuals that came, Mary Stopes, Planned Parenthood, all these very radical groups, to suppress conscience and teach it at nursing schools, midwifery schools, medical schools, I thought that was far-fetched. We have stumbled upon it. That's what's happened here. And the Department of Health is fully, fully behind all that. So that's where we are now. We lost the case, and we are human beings, and for 3 days it was awful. It was terrible. It was really bad. But God raises us up. And as a Catholic Christian, I often think, well, we prayed that hard, and so many people prayed with us internationally. That's not a loss. We don't know God's mind. And when he hung on the cross, who thought that was a victory? Now, the fact that I'm here today, that's not my choice. I like to meet you all. It's very nice. But I wouldn't have come halfway around the world to speak, but you've got issues here now as well, and some of what we've experienced, it may be of help to you or not, I don't know. But I found myself in the different talks I've been given the past 2.5 weeks is I'll bend it according to who I'm speaking to, but I don't write anything down. It comes from the heart. You're a doctor, and some of the doctors I've met, I agree with them. I was a wee bit disappointed. They mentioned about they wouldn't be fighting it on conscience. This is the abortion issue. Well, this argument is about conscience. If I was to argue about abortion, I will say it. Medically, it's bad for women. You can argue that completely. Completely. But I was a wee bit disappointed that they said what they said, because it implies that we should have been taking another argument. And well, anyway, that's nothing. But this argument is about conscience, and it's going to cover all areas, end-of-life issues. And when I hear them saying, you don't have to do this, you know, these rules and laws that get passed all over the world just now, no, you don't have to take part, you know, in conscience you can withdraw, they've completely undermined it. There will be no chance to uphold. Personally, wild horses wouldn't make me do what they're trying to force me to do. And there's nothing more comfortable to sleep on at night than a clear conscience. So if you've got any other questions, I would ask you, just hang in there, whatever it is. You're obviously all here for a particular reason. No matter how hard it is in your varied areas, it can be done. And I tell young people, it's only dead fish that go downstream. I would rather be known for trying and failing than not tried at all. And other people look at you, and if you've been given special grace to fight something, and the analogy I've been using since I came here, I don't know why, it's about the pilots. Number of people throughout the world that have got pilot licenses is probably quite a significant number. But the number that are fighter pilots are few. And then the number that are astronauts is even fewer. Now, I know I met Dr. Hobart, right. And now he was very upset and despondent when I spoke to him at the Life dinner there just a week and a half ago. And we had a good conversation. But he was despondent because when he went out and spoken for the good of women, not just the baby, nobody came with him. And that is so disappointing. I told my colleagues from the word go, I didn't care who was with me. I would like them if they felt they're very strong about it. It would be good. But my carrying on with this battle was not dependent on who was there or who wasn't there. And I think that same thing applies to anybody who's been given grace, wherever you are, to carry on. Don't look behind, because it won't happen. You'll be disappointed. And if you've been given grace, you don't know that the others have or haven't. Mostly they've not. But that will happen over a period of time. But Gandhi said, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, and then you win. Now I think we're at the stage of fighting. And to be honest with you, I'm quite glad. Because although we seem to have lost, back home, more people I know are now actually shaken by this decision and are starting to come out and starting to speak, starting to get in touch with organisations. How can we help one another? What do we need to do to shore up things? Had we won, people would have just, like, you know, sat back and thought, that's fine, because most people thought we would win. So the loss is actually resulting in, a movement of activity which can only snowball. It won't go back in. We're the genie that's out of the box, or the can, or whatever it is, you know. So anyway, there's more to it, but that's what... If you want to ask any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
That was a talk by Mary Dugan on Glasgow Midwives and the Fight for Conscience. For more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.